Hello and welcome to Taking Care of Business Live in the studio at RPPFM. And I'm obviously not your regular host, Jackie Mitchell, who today is busy taking care of her own business. I'm Toby Travener, and you may have heard me on other Taking Care of Business shows as a technology and people influence kind of commentator. But today it's my pleasure to be sitting in the big chair, and it's great to have your company today as we talk all things business. Now, speaking of business, today's show is proudly sponsored by eView Real Estate, and of course, community radio stations like this one can't actually provide the fantastic services that we're doing without their generous support. Now, today, our show is based around the concept of an organizational system, or put simply, how a business actually works and communicates internally. So in this particular way of looking at business, there are three main elements. That's process, in other words, the scripts and the rules that we follow to get things done. There's technology, the second one, the tools and the data that we use to support the processes, as well as the last particular element, which is people, the minds and bodies, including team members, stakeholders, suppliers, and customers. Now, speaking of people, with me in the studio today are our business experts to talk about how important each of these are and how they need to be aligned to get absolutely fantastic and strong results. Now, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of process with Michael Beresford, who is a Director of Investment Services at Open Corp. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Toby. Great to be here.
Well, Michael, I got to ask the question. How did you come up with the name Open Corp?
It really came from one of my business partners. Just thought about it one day. We're all about transparency and openness, so it seemed a pretty logical fit that we take an education-based focus and we like to share information. So open it was.
Well, there you go. Now, if everyone's busily looking on the internet, the interweb, to see what Open does, Open Corp is both a property investment and advisory and education business, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So we're property investment specialists with two divisions. We've got a property investment arm that is education based. We then help people with their investment strategy to execute that and provide ongoing mentoring. And then our funds management division is about syndicated property development projects, providing return and profit to investors at the end of those projects.
Are you worried about this talk about negative gearing?
How did you know that's all I've been talking about all week? No, I'm not worried. Look, the media have got a job to do. They like to create headlines, but when you actually drill into the detail, the potential changes, I think, that may come in will not be all that major. They're just trying to get some leverage early on in the election campaign.
Well, we're going to hear more about the processes that you use to actually deliver your services later on. Also, to chat about technology, among other topics, is Australia's leading futurist, Mr. Chris Riddell.
Hello, Toby. Wow, that's, leading futurist. That's a...
How about preeminent? Eminent futurist.
There you go. Futurist, that interesting title, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. What on earth is a futurist?
A futurist, Toby, this one's the one we've talked about a lot in the past. And a futurist for me is somebody that's looking at the trends and patterns that are going on all around the world. I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever today things are moving quicker than they've ever moved. We know that as business owners or employees within the companies we work for, and even at home. I mean, you can see how technology has really shaped even our homes now. And my job is to look at how that pace of change translates into business outcomes so that we can have better and more sustainable businesses.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because keeping up with technology or being able to predict it seems to be very difficult. And I tried to find who originally coined the first version of this quote, but it was like, predicting the future is actually fraught with problems because it's all about the future.
it's an interesting area of work. And funny enough, if you want to look at futurism in who started this in the first place, particularly in the corporate area, It's actually fashion companies. The fashion industry coined this whole phrase of futurism, looking at what fashion trends were going to be coming up so that they could design clothes and work with those latest trends. So fashion industry have actually had futurists in for years. years.
Yeah.
We're now seeing the business space within corporate pick up this in a much bigger way. And do you know the big thing? It's not about having a crystal ball. It's not about making wild statements. I actually believe that in order to be able to see what's coming ahead in the future, you take a look at your past. If you want to be able to tell a story of what's going to happen, take a look at what's happened behind you.
So you might be called a pastist or a nowist.
Nowist is the other one. Nowist, very much so. It's an interesting space. But here's the big thing that we definitely know today. Times have never been as uncertain as what they are, but businesses are able to tap into this. If you can find your happy space with uncertainty and volatility and this world that we live in, if you can find a place that makes you happy with that, you will be a huge success.
Well, we're going to look forward to talking more about that. Definitely. Because I think all of us are looking for what that holy grail is in the particular industry that we're working with. Now, speaking of the grail or the holy grail, there aren't very many people who have actually made it to the summit of Everest. And we're just calculating off air a moment ago that it's something like 0.00005% of the world's population has made it up there. And with me to talk about people is one of those people. It's Nick Farr from the Everest Academy and Nick Farr Leadership. Welcome.
Thank you, Toby. It's a very kind introduction, and as usual, you've put some spin on climbing Everest that I hadn't considered before I came here today.
Well, I did it with the Australian population too, and it's something like 0.00002% of the Australian population, something like only 50 to 75 people. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I don't know the exact number. Maybe 50 or 60.
Yeah.
50 or 60 currently, yes.
Now, I would imagine that when you're going for an amazing feat like climbing Everest, the people around is going to be really important. We're talking about people with you today, but how do you actually how do you ensure in an organization that people are kind of climbing in the right direction, heading for the same spot?
Well, how long is a piece of string and how long have we got? That's broadly speaking, there's so many different considerations in terms of getting everybody on that same page, be it a business, a corporate environment, be it a sporting environment, a team. We work very hard at the Everest Academy on probably some, you know, they're not typically new trends, but we certainly look very hard at developing emotional intelligence as opposed to IQ, as opposed to technical skills. We're all about leadership development, personal development, developing the person before the performance. So, when we're climbing Everest, you've had time to vet your team. Everybody knows who's who. Everybody knows the role they've got to play, and everybody's pretty confident they know what's going to happen if somebody, is exposed to a pressure situation. In business, it's exactly the same. You know, it's all about understanding the strengths and the weaknesses of the people that you have working for you, working with you, identifying where those people are possibly going to derail if they're under pressure, and really maximising and understanding your people so that you can use the strengths and the things that are important to them.
It's almost like valuing the differences rather than being annoyed by them. People have the skill set that you'll be able to use in different circumstances.
Yeah, valuing, but really identifying and understanding. Yeah. You know, there's so many tools out there nowadays that can really help those environments understand and get great insight into their people. But even before that, we're trying to, you know, you need to develop that, the person, the worker, the employee, the sports person, whoever we're talking about, they have to get that insight first.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I don't know about you, Michael Beresford from Open Court, but may I grow old looking like Tom Jones?
I'm sure you wouldn't be the only one that would want that.
Well, I don't know. The other gentleman in the studio with me today, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but maybe Michael looks like a bit of a young Tom Jones. I'm just putting it out there because we can't actually see what he looks like on radio.
I need to breathalyze you this morning.
So,
flattery will get you everywhere.
Yeah. So, look, we're talking about process with you, Michael. Yep. My understanding is that when somebody's going to invest in a property, it can be a rather daunting experience. So, what do you do to make that a little easier?
I guess what we do is exactly that, follow a process. From Chris's introduction before, he said, you know, if you want to take a look at the future, well, the first place to start is taking a look at your past. And that's exactly what we've done. We're all investors ourselves, and we didn't do it perfectly the first time, the second time or the third time in our experience. But I guess learning from all of that and then finding out what works and then simply applying that same process over and over while it seems quite dull and boring, it's super effective. You know, and just for the listeners out there, I guess the most common example I use is, you know, think about how you get to work every day.
Yep.
Most people drive exactly the same way or ride the same way or walk the same way because they've worked out the quickest way to get from A to B and they just repeat it day after day.
Yeah, sure, sure. Now, it's look, I think following a process is really important, and I come across a lot of organisations myself who have processes that are locked in the heads of an individual, and it's very hard to get it out. So what have you done about that? Because that basically means that only one person can actually do the work.
Yeah, sure. And I think that that's, especially with small business, that can be one of the major things because the business owner takes everything on. They're the expert. They do everything from start to finish. And then people get used to what they do, and it's very hard to delegate tasks and grow from there. So what we've done is we've set up basically a process, start to finish, from marketing right through to when a sale is closed or the service finishes, map out every single task along that process and make sure that we can automate it. We have a written report of standard operating procedure and measurable written reports that can track progress at each of those stages. So I guess the best way to think about it is when my business partners and I set up OpenCorp, it was really about how do we put a process in place to ensure that we could take 6 months off and not have to worry about it.
And some of your business partners are doing that right now, by the sounds of things.
Yeah. More so than I do.
off making a movie I saw in LA.
Yeah, that's their latest little exercise. Having a lot of fun with it as well, I might add.
Yeah. Now, look, let's talk about property investment for our listeners. You also use a knockout process to work out where to buy an investment property. I'm hoping you might be able to take us through that.
Yeah, sure. Really, what it is a process of elimination. There's that word again, isn't it? So I think, you know, a common mistake that a lot of people can make is, or two common mistakes. Number one, they look around the corner from where they live because it feels comfortable and it's what they know, and getting emotional about what they're doing. The second mistake they make is they try to pick the perfect investment every time. The way we look at it is that it's a process of elimination. So starting with, you know, looking nationally, Australia-wide, where are the locations in terms of
what happened to those great toys
that you don't want to be right now?
Yeah, well, I'd like to know what happened to those great toys as well, but I actually want to know what happened to those great locations. So around Australia, this is, you know, I'm taking a little bit of Chris's thunder here. I'm going to get you to predict something. what city should we be investing in?
Look, we think, you know, based on that process of elimination, Brisbane and Melbourne are the places to be. Perth has some potential into the future. Just need to make sure that the demand is there from a jobs perspective.
Sure.
And Sydney obviously has seen tremendous growth. So it does make a lot of sense to be buying at the top of the market.
I've got a question for you, Michael. Where's the worst place to invest in Australia? Where would I not want to put my money?
Any mining town.
We had a good, did you see the article that went out, that new show that 60 Minutes was it the other week, that property investor that was cover of a magazine, and she was then complaining she'd lost all of her money but she put it in a boomtown. That's crazy.
Well,
surely
I didn't see 60 Minutes, but my phone rang 12 times before lunchtime on Monday, so I'm pretty well up to speed with what went down.
We're actually talking about that. It's let's talk about the concept that any industry has some sharks in it. So how do I spot a shark?
Apart from futurism.
Apart from futurism, of course. Yeah, but how do I spot a shark?
Look, anything that's get rich quick or sounds too good to be true is generally, you know, go with your gut instinct on that. The reason why I mentioned capital cities before, again, slow, takes time, it's get rich slowly, but it's all about a process to mitigate risk.
Yep.
And supply and demand is the most basic fundamental that drives price growth in anything. So, you know, when the cyclones come in, the price of bananas goes up simply because there's less supply. It's exactly the same with housing. So where we have an undersupply situation and we have really robust population growth in the capital cities, then, you know, growth over time will be slow and steady in the upward direction is what we see.
So you've said Brisbane and Melbourne. As such, I would imagine then once you've got a location, you need to narrow it down into a suburb. What are the things that you look for there?
Yeah, sure. So again, it's available land supply and demand. Typically, what drives demand are jobs. So not only proximity to the CBD, we don't have to be within, you know, 5-minute walk of the CBD, but proximity not only to the CBD, but to employment hubs or principal activity centres, as the government's
called. Okay, so honestly, so down in Victoria, the Mornington area might be one of those things that we're talking about, the areas that we're talking about.
Yeah, well, Frankston, just down the road, is one of the principal activity centres that the government have identified as an area for development. Dandenong and Ringwood are others. So if you're familiar with those areas, you will have seen over the last 5, 10, 15 years how those areas have really developed and benefited from an injection of government money.
So let's say I've narrowed it down then to a suburb. What sort of property should I be looking for?
Okay. What you want to be looking for is what we call optimum size and quality. So the whole purpose of our process is that one property is not going to make you wealthy. It needs to be a repeatable process. And fundamental to that are getting improved bank valuations on your property. So you've probably heard of the worst house in the best street. That's what we look for. We look for solid land value, you know, about half of the property's value being in the land value. And we look to have an efficient house where it's a good quality and it's fit for purpose, but it's not massive and overcapitalized, where typically people that get emotional about the house build nice big houses. Builders love big houses, magazines love big houses, but they cost a lot more to build and the house actually drops in value over time. So it's about getting that balance right.
All right. So once you've done that, I gather, it's about getting the right tenant in.
Yeah.
And when you say optimum size and quality, it's about, I suppose, tenants looking for a 4-bedroom house. It doesn't matter how big those bedrooms are to a certain extent. Is that what you're talking about?
That they need to be the right size for the demographic. So don't confuse optimum size and quality with small and boxy.
Yep.
Or cheap and nasty. Mm. It's far from that. It's just making sure that you have that trade-off between what's really appealing and what's cost-effective. You know, so dripping gold taps are not going to get you any more in rental income. But you know, a well-designed house with minimum wasted space and large living area is going to get you more tenant appeal and therefore drive your rent up over time as well.
What about the types of things that you might want in your own house, like a media room? Or in Chris's case, a Cisco server center or something like that. I know he's not a techo in that sense, but you know, what about the types of things you might want yourself? Will that appeal to tenants?
Most of the time, they're not essential right. in an investment property. So we have a saying, people rent bedrooms. That's what determines the rent. You'll see a lot of builders have media rooms in there. A family will generally need a second living area. It doesn't need to be as big as a media room, but just somewhere for the kids and their toys to sit quietly away from where the parents want some peace and quiet.
Well, I think you asked a good question there, the types of rooms. One I've got though is new, old. Do you buy a new build or is it good to buy older and do it up and paint it up? And if I'm going to do it up, how much do I do it up? How much do I spend on it?
Yeah, so we start new from the beginning, Chris.
Oh, why is that? Besides the fact that you can build optimally, I suppose.
Yeah, it's four key things, really. Yeah. First and foremost, you can get more rent for a new property than an old one.
I didn't know that. Okay, so that's good to know.
If you think about how you can hold a property effectively and not have it impact your lifestyle,
yeah,
it's all about maximise your rental income and maximise your tax benefits so that your residual cost is minimal. So that's the second one. You can maximise depreciation on a brand new property.
Of course, yeah.
The other two get to risk mitigation. So firstly, minimizing the costs that you put in because you're only paying stamp duty on the land component. And finally, when you're building a house, you can see exactly what you get. You can monitor the quality while it's being built. It's not covered up with the plaster. And yeah, you're just mitigating maintenance risk as well with a new build.
You know, Michael, it sounds like you've got a potential new client here in Chris. Taking Care of Business this morning with Toby Travener, and I've got a fantastic guest here. I kind of wish Jackie Mitchell was here as well, our regular host. She would have loved talking with these people, including our next guest, Chris Riddell. We had a little bit of tech, I suppose, tech-themed music to bring you back in. That was that's a Daft Punk song, but this time sung by a group called Pentatonix. Have you heard of them?
Do you know, I am the worst person to ask for anything to do with any pop culture. I was on 20 to 1, you know, that countdown show on Channel 9 the other week, and they were asking me questions about show. I've got no idea. I'm the worst person to bring up on that.
Well, the interesting thing about that particular track is that they're a cappella.
Uh-huh.
So there's no instruments at all. All done by their voices, which is kind of the antithesis of technology, I suppose. Now, we're all going to ask the question about trends for small business and how many organisations really struggle with what's happening right now and into the future. We've all heard about the disruptors like Uber and Airbnb and so on, but how can I, as a small business, actually look for what the next disruptor might be?
Do you know, any business, big or small, you can be... I often think about my fiance's mum. She owns a hairdressing salon in Baldwin, and she's been doing that forever. Yet she still is impacted by disruption and by change. And it can be as simple as, how do you use an iPad? How do you use a new smartphone? If we look back at the amount of change we've seen over the last 15 to 20 years, it has been phenomenal. And Apple have been at the center of transforming what a smartphone means. You remember the Nokia era that we were in?
All had one.
Exactly. We loved them. We had them. Even BlackBerry were top of the pile in owning the whole phone space.
Did you know that Nokia, you know, what was the 3380 or whatever it was, sold 280 million units?
I would expect you to know a statistic like that.
But we all had one at the time.
We loved them as well.
Yeah, what's interesting,
got a BlackBerry now, by the way, you need to seriously go and check that stuff.
Well, there's a new BlackBerry Passport, and I understand that the latest
still
BlackBerry,
making them?
The latest BlackBerry actually runs, wait for it, Android as an operating system.
Well, there you go.
So, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you've just described Nokia and RIM, Research and Motion, which is the BlackBerry brand, as being the
that
two...
used to be, they're now BlackBerry.
Well, that's right, owned. But the two creators, when you think about the phone and the smartphone market, and they're virtually irrelevant now.
So the point there is, you make a fantastic point. They were the creators of the phone market, Toby, and most of your listeners here today will know that. So what happened? What happened that a company that many of us had only ever really just heard about suddenly came in and took that entire market? The way they did that was they put the customer at the front of what they're doing. And this applies to any business. And that's a big statement to make. And what does that kind of big flowery statement mean? If you look at what the technology that sits in an iPhone, the iPhone itself as the device is not that revolutionary. It is the concept that they brought of using apps on the phone. If you look at your iPhone now, your smartphone, you can do more on a smartphone app with your bank than you could even do when you walked into a branch before the iPhone existed.
Absolutely.
Apple changed that themselves as a mobile phone company. I can transfer money internationally. I can open a new account. I can manage multiple accounts on my phone. I can see transactions coming in there. I can do everything and more that a teller used to be able to do in a branch all through my device. And Apple were the first to do that. Yes, BlackBerry did smartphones, and yes, Nokia did them, but they didn't create that app-centric hub.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think the demise of those two was the difficulty.
Lack of innovation.
Yeah, difficulty in even being able to buy apps. And once that happens, then none of the app developers will write apps for it because they're not going to make any money out of it.
Exactly. And Apple really owned this space and took control of it, because BlackBerry did have an app store, but it was, to keep this polite, because we're obviously during the day, it was rubbish to put it...
you had to have a PayPal account to even make it work.
It was silly. Apple just made it easy.
Yeah.
We now live in a world where we expect everything to be easy, and that is down to a mobile phone company. We expect our taxi booking service to be easy, and that's because of Apple. So you now get these businesses like Uber that exist, and they've completely transformed our expectation of what we expect now when we have a taxi. They've transformed what we see as a bank now. Apple have changed how we have our relationship with the bank. They've transformed how we email. It used to be very elitist to have a BlackBerry and email coming in into your fingertips. Now everyone has email on their devices.
I was about to say, it was the killer app 15 years ago.
I think, look,
email was at that time.
The irony is now that actually email is a bit passe. It's that old hat technology. Universities in Australia have stopped rolling out email over the last few years because they see it as passe. We're now in a much more social type platforms. We're using social type tools a lot more, and email is now taking a back step. Do you remember what it used to be cool to get an email? You'd go, hey, I'm important. I've got an email coming to my inbox. Now we're overloaded with email. It is so noisy.
I've had 11 in the last 5 minutes.
Wow, you're even more important than I am.
Must be. let me just have a look, though. The majority is indeed
yours
spam.
Yours are spam.
Oh, no, probably... no. They're actually Twitter notifications that you've mentioned me.
So actually, nobody loves you whatsoever. You're just getting automated notifications. Look, there's no... So coming back to the what do small businesses do? And I come back to this hairdresser analogy. You've got to make it so that people can interact with your business easily. Mm. It's not about just saying, putting up a website. Don't go and try and think of an app to make. That's a it's probably not relevant to 95% of the people, but make it so that people can find you online, that you have a presence online. Because here's the thing. Here's the other thing that has fundamentally changed in our world. A few years ago, if I wanted to go and buy a TV, I'd go and ask my mate down the road, Bob, who might have been my cousin or a friend, and said, look, hey, Bob, you're the tech guy. What TV should I go and buy? What's the latest and greatest? I will now go online and look for reviews, and I trust the reviews of thousands of people I will never meet. So trust is now a new currency in this world that we live in. We trust people we've never met, and businesses have to tap into this. So if I want to find you as a hairdressing salon in Baldwin, and I'm looking for something, if I can't find you, I ain't going to go to you. More importantly, if I can't find people that have reviewed you and find people that are talking about you and your business, these ambassadors, brand people who are advocating for your brand, then you don't exist. Mm. And that's the challenge. And you know what? It doesn't take a lot of money to do anything like that, to get your presence up. In fact, it can be free. It takes intent. You've got to go out there to want to do something. And it's actually really easy.
And you, it creates transparency, doesn't it? Because totally. These people are not aligned to you in any way. They're going to either say you are fantastic or not. By the way, you've mentioned this hairdressing salon in Baldwin a number of times. You might as well mention the name.
it's Sue. She's a lovely lady in Baldwin, and she's got a wonderful salon. She caters for a particular niche of the market, so I'm not quite sure she want me advertising.
maybe the niche is somewhat... Well, and that's actually interesting, because a niche may not be best suited to technology.
Absolutely. Not everybody, but technology play... Here's the thing I promise you, Toby, and everyone out there. Whether you like it or not, technology plays a part now in every single part of our lives. Yep. Our televisions, our dishwashers, our fridges, everything in our lives now wants to be connected online. It's all part of this internet of everything, or the internet of things, and more devices are going to connect online. I was driving a driverless car here in Melbourne just a week and a half ago. The next phase, we'll see driverless cars now in Australia.
So you were being driven in a driverless car.
I was being driven in a driverless car. Yeah, so I wasn't touching the steering wheel. Here's the crazy thing. Within 3 years, I promise you, you'll be able to buy your own driverless car. And the next bit that where I saw we'll start to see this take off is traffic lights will start talking to your cars. Because that's the only gap at the moment. The driverless cars can't tell when the traffic lights are red or green.
Yep.
You have to take over control. It is one step off now. Cars talking to each other and the traffic lights. So technology now, even with the oldest of cars and the oldest of things, if you're trying to resist it, resistance is futile now. You have to jump on board.
Thank you very much for that Star Trek quote as well.
Star Trek, was that?
Yeah.
Really? I don't even watch Star Trek.
Well, there you go. Resistance is futile. look, it can be difficult. And I know my late mother took me ages of patient instruction to get her comfortable to use an ATM. But once she got over that fact, she was actually quite enjoyed the fact that she could take money out when needed.
I've actually got another one here to leave you with and finish you off on this point. ATMs. When the ATM first came out in Australia, there were protests all over the country. Sydney had hundreds of people protesting. I've got video footage from the old ABC era, and people were saying it would lose people jobs. These machines were going to take jobs. Banks were going to disappear. We have this fear with technology that we fear it's going to take over. And since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, that has not been being the case. We've got more jobs today than we've ever had in history. We've got more people on the planet. And the big thing here, we keep hearing topics in the media. It's a bit like Michael was talking around earlier with media have to make stories out of things. I think we've got exactly the same thing happening at the moment when we hear the media saying robots are going to take over, jobs are going to be wiped out. It's absolute rubbish. There's robots are going to take away jobs that are the more mundane, more menial tasks that we do, but we'll see new jobs created as a result of this. And the ATM one's a brilliant example.
And it sounds like one of the new jobs might be robotic engineer.
Totally. If you want a job of the future, here's my big one, healthcare. The way we're now living with technology, making us live longer and better, get into healthcare. It's the big industry.
What a fantastic prediction. I think the prediction of the future there is going to be a good one. We've got Nick Farr here, not to be confused with the other guy who has an extra name on the end.
He gets a lot more Google hits than
I can imagine. Nick Farr Jones, the rugby player, but Nick Farr from Nick Farr Leadership as well as the Everest Academy. We were talking about technology before, Nick, and one of the things that came up was how do you trust it? Right, and you know, we're talking about driverless cars and letting that car put the brake on at the last minute on your behalf. Yeah. I would imagine trust is a really important thing when you're working in teams.
Yeah, and look, I made a note actually. I've made a couple of notes, some from Michael there and from Chris. Trust and intent were the key words for me. They were fantastic, and it's obviously critical. But how do we even get to that stage? You know, and speaking very broadly, what we find in business is that the business managers and supervisors and executives alike, and even the processes that already exist in those businesses, they're putting the who, the how, and the why way before the what. And by that I mean, you know, they're sort of looking at the performance and what a person's doing without even understanding what drives that person, what motivates that person, how that person's made up. You know, that's kind of the starting point for us, and the way we work is first creating fantastic insight for the person themselves, but also for the business, for the business mentors and for the supervisors and the managers in the business to be able to understand what makes their people tick. That's got to be the starting point.
Mm. It's look, when we understand what motivates an individual, I suppose you can work in with that. Can you give us an indication of what it was like? And I'd like to talk about the work that you actually do now, but I would like to be a voyeur and hear a bit more about what it was like to climb Everest to start off with, and what it was, I suppose, getting the team together to make that happen.
Yeah, well, look, our team, I guess, you know, going back to the Everest days, which was, I was quite young then, Toby.
It was the first police team.
Yeah, we were the first Australian police team, 2005. And that was on the back of one of our climbing team members dying 2 years before. So it was a really difficult time. We all went through a lot of stuff. But I guess what it taught, it certainly taught me, and in hindsight, I was able to, you know, put together a whole lot of ways that I developed resilience, that I learnt resilience, that I learnt what made high performing teams work. I learnt where we were effective, I learnt where we weren't effective. And that's the stuff, I think, from Everest that I'm eternally grateful for. You know, climbing Everest was fantastic. I worked hard to achieve it. I wouldn't have achieved it without the fantastic support and effort of the Sherpa people that we climb with, because really they're the unsung heroes of pretty well every Everest ascent that ever occurs. You know, there's probably the tiniest percentage would be successful without those guys. So, you know, that puts it in perspective. But, you know, and it was building on, I guess, my relationships with some of those Sherpa people. And one of my best friends now is a guy called Tikka Temang, and we run the business in conjunction with him. He's got his office in Kathmandu. And, you know, I had a long police career, but it was really only after prolonged and sustained contact and learning with these guys, with these remarkable, determined, humble people that I really learned the essence of leadership, the essence of trust, the essence of influence, judgment, humility, courage, all that stuff that's absolutely pivotal in getting you, I guess, to the top of Everest. It's the same stuff that's pivotal in creating a successful business environment or a successful environment for a sporting team, an elite team.
When you think about, I suppose, pulling all those people together, you made it mention a couple of comments there. It's about seeing what people are good at, what they're not good at, how they work together.
Yep.
Sounds to me you have to have enough insight to get out of your own head and start watching what's around you to be able to be a good leader.
Yeah. Well, that's a great observation. You know, I think the ability to just watch and observe and not comment is something that gets left behind. It's very difficult for people to do, by and large. You know, and this is part of the way that we develop better decision making processes, better judgment. You know, is to be able to just not react too quickly. You know, to be able to take it all in. Yeah, certainly. I mean, our leadership model focuses on what I mentioned before: courage, humility, judgment, and influence, with a healthy dose of resilience and understanding that, you know, success is earned. So, you know, when you know, they're fancy tags and they're fancy titles, but they can be stripped down pretty easily. The great thing for all that stuff is it's highly coachable. We're not talking about IQ here, we're talking about EQ. You know, you may be familiar with the great Robert Hogan of Hogan Assessment Systems, which is a diagnostic tool. It's a fantastic tool, we use it. He says that, you know, one of his famous quotes is everything that is important in life is other than IQ. You know, we are primarily here to get along and to get ahead. And that sadly doesn't have a lot to do with our technical ability or our technical skills, but our EQ. And things like the way we make decisions, the way we influence people, you know, our ability to be empathetic, et cetera, all that stuff is highly coachable, highly learnable. And that's the thing that we, you know, that we particularly work on with our clients, is coaching that.
Now, Chris Riddell, do you find that with technology, I suppose, becoming more and more prevalent, that people are losing and missing those skills?
I don't. Look, I think what technology does, so I talk about this mega trend, if you like that kind of stuff, this mega trend called network acceleration. And what that means is we now are able, because of technology, to access more people than we have ever been before in history. So that really is amplifying our ability to learn faster and quicker and get more knowledge on board. I like the thing that we were talking about there just a moment ago, which is around trust. And I touched on this earlier. Trust has been redefined now because of technology, primarily also because of the big crash we saw in the GFC a few years ago. People trust people still in a big way, but technology has now opened new avenues for us to be able to meet people and trust people in different ways as well. So that plays a huge part in the world we're in.
Now, Nick, what sort of technology do you use then to help facilitate this trust in people?
Well, there's no magic cures. And I guess from a technology point of view, I don't have a magical elixir for that. You know, what is fundamental to what we do is firstly, as I've explained, generating that insight, you know, for the person. And then, you know, the makeup of our programs is that we'll typically take them away. We'll take them away into a wilderness environment or a high altitude environment. And only after we've performed some type of assessment on that person, diagnostic assessment, so we understand what drives them, where their strengths are, where their opportunities for development are, can we structure a program that lets them play to their strengths, or a program that lets them derail safely, you know, because it's when we're under stress, when we're under pressure, that we generally have a range of competencies which might come apart.
Well, a different set of behaviours often comes out. The person who's very calm in a normal environment can be quite wild in a difficult environment, and vice versa.
The thing for me that's great here about what Nick is saying, and I think again is the checkpoint for us as humans, is technology is allowing us now to do this.
Yeah.
A few years ago, we didn't have access to this kind of technology, and technology allows us to drive deep insights about us, how we're performing as humans, and more importantly, what we can do to make our lives better. We've now moved in this era that I call out of sick care. So we don't just try and fix ourselves when we're sick. We're now in this era of well care, where we try and make ourselves better. And how do we do that? It's by using technology, wearables, smart devices, this technology Nick's talking about here. It allows us to really be able to do something special. That's the tipping point.
It's interesting. It's some might say it's an Eastern medical philosophy. I know if you have a Chinese health practitioner, you pay them a monthly basis.
Really?
Right, yeah. You don't pay them when you're sick, because then they failed.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting? It's a completely different way of looking at
like
healthcare.
Subscription.
Yeah, you pay them to keep you well. And
And it's about getting on the front foot. And that's exactly what Chris was getting to there. You know, in 12 minutes, Toby, I could give you a world-class, you know, incredibly validated tool, and I will know absolutely everything about your decision making.
How amazing is
that? Your approach to decision making, because we're all incredibly biased when it comes to decision making. We probably don't realize that, but we are. This is why a lot of us keep making that same mistake over and over again. You know, and then your reactions to feedback, you know, when you get it wrong. And this is the critical stuff. And in 12 minutes, I can find out that stuff about you. Are you reward seeking? You know, do you make decisions based on threat avoidance? Are you a strategic or a tactical thinker? Are you a data driven or an intuitive person? You know, my business partner will analyze.
We should have done this on the show. We should have done this.
I think there might be an opportunity next time. Next time, there's an hour, there's 12 minutes each, 48 minutes with some.
And I guess, you know, I missed that cue before, but that is a way that we can use technology to find this stuff out. So if you're, you know, if you're a 2020 cricketer, and I use that example for a reason, and you're in the heat of that battle, you know, you've got 20 overs to get it right, you know, surely, you know, if your coaches can know exactly the type of decision maker you are and how you're going to react in that cauldron, and when you're really under pressure, what a fantastic head start you've got on the competition.
So what would be some tips that you can give our listeners about what makes good leadership? And I know it's going to be different for each individual, but there must be some characteristics or some ideas that can translate across all different types of people.
Yeah, well, look again, and I alluded to it before, but our model revolves around courage, humility, influence, and judgment. So good leaders typically make better decisions more often. They've got a range of ways that they can really influence, you know, not just their peers, but, you know, the people that are important in their life. You know, some people rely on charm to do that, but there's a lot of influencing tactics, you know, and we've all seen them, you know. A fantastic influencing tactic is one of consultation, because it gives everybody a way to buy into an idea, even if it was their idea in the first place. You know, the best way to get somebody to do something is to make them want to do it. So how do we make them want to do it? So, you know, there's a lot of great ways to influence: threatening and ostracising people, and, you know, pulling rank. These aren't great ways to influence people, but sadly, a lot of leaders, that's all they've got in their toolbox. You know, do you have the courage of your convictions, Toby? Have you got enough humility to understand other people, the needs and the wants of people around you? You know, when they're going well, when they're struggling, there's a whole range of things. And again, I keep bringing it back. These are all emotional, intelligence-based competencies. They're all highly coachable. So, you know, if the listeners are out there and they're thinking, yeah, it's not me, and I'm not like that, or I'm not wired like that, how can I improve? Well, you know, you certainly can, by getting on the front foot and using some of the technology that we've talked about.
But it sounds like you need somebody else to be your mirror.
Well, you need accountability and you need measurement. You know, that's fundamental. You know, you need a baseline, so you've got somewhere where you're growing from, and you need some accountability around it. You know, if we take you away, if we do all this great stuff and we put you in the wilderness or a high altitude environment and we teach you these things and we bring you back to sea level and let you go, that's probably not going to have the impact that it could. You need follow-up, you need support. People need that made relevant to their own realities.
So, thank you, Nick. So, Chris, what's one tip that you can give our listeners?
The thing for me that I always talk around with tips is, do you know, it isn't about going out and buying the latest gadget and trying to get your head around that, or buying the latest technology or getting the best website or anything like that. The irony is, as much as I work in the tech space to some degree, it's just go out there and work with trying to shift your mindset around. I'm going to now embrace volatility. The world we're in now is more fast-paced than it's ever been. There's more uncertainty. And the thing for you is a mindset around going, I'm not going to look at the world as glass half empty. I'm going to go out with a positive spin. Anybody that's a success out there and doing what they're doing, do they get up in the morning and have this negative view on the world? Far from it. They're all positive thinkers. And it comes back to the same kind of mindset thing here. They're helping others. I believe in, I'm quite a philosophical person, going helping others, grow other people's business, help to be a thought leader, inspire others, and you'll find that that'll be a great success point for you.
And you'll often see hints from other industries that might work into yours.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Michael Beresford, what's one thought that you can give our listeners today?
Look, the main thing I'd leave small business owners and operators with, Toby, is keep it simple. People overcomplicate business. Coming from somewhere, we have monthly auditing, we have asset compliance, we have all of this compliance committees that we need to satisfy as part of our business. But if you think of it at a basic level, write down every task. that you do. Work out which ones provide dollar value for your business and which ones can be done outsourced to someone who's worth less per hour than what you are. And that then gives you a subset of things that you can be great at, you can drive your business with, and you can have a whole lot less stress in the process because you're not trying to do everything.
Oh, fantastic. Look, I can tell you right now, admin is not my forte. I have somebody looking after that. No, you wouldn't know it, would you, Chris? But I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our guests today and for making it so pleasurable for me as guest host of Taking Care of Business. Michael Beresford from Open Corp, Chris Riddell, our Australia's ultimate Uber futurist, and Nick Farr from the Everest Academy. Look, it's been a real pleasure hosting today's Taking Care of Business on RPPFM, filling in for Jackie Mitchell, who I believe will be back next week for another jam-packed show full of hints, tips, and fantastic ideas to help you take care of your business. You can also see Jackie on Sky News, Sky Business News, on Tuesdays at 2:30 p.m. And there are also other episodes of Taking Care of Business on the RPPFM website. Just click on the podcast tab. I'll be back as a regular sometime soon, but until then, I hope your business has huge successes and that you personally are blessed with many moments of unexpected delight. I've been Toby Travener. We're going to leave you with a bit of Kylie with So Now Goodbye. We look forward to being with you next Friday, 11 a.m. But in the meantime, keep taking care of your business.